Today is Friday, July 3rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the president plays down fears as the U.S. reaches a worrisome coronavirus milestone.
The crisis is being handled.
New lawsuits are seeking to hold the fossil fuel industry accountable for climate change damages. Also ahead, a tense mood as mourners pay respects to a popular Ethiopian singer. It's all on today's International Edition. After days of record spikes in new COVID-19 cases and hospitals warning they could run out of beds, the Trump administration Thursday sought to convey that all is well in the battle against the coronavirus. Cases in the U.S. rose by over 50,000 Thursday, setting a record for a third consecutive day. New infections rose in 37 out of 50 U.S. states in the past 14 days, compared with the 2 weeks prior in early June. Florida, reporting the biggest increase of any state so far, recorded over 10,000 new cases in a single day. But with spikes in coronavirus cases around the country, President Trump's attitude toward masks may slowly be shifting. AP correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
The president says he's all for masks. I think masks are good, though he's avoided being photographed wearing one. But in an interview yesterday with Fox Business Network's The Clayman Countdown, he recounted one that he wore.
It was a dark black mask, and I thought it looked okay. It looked like the Lone Ranger.
The president's shift came after top Republicans suggested he wear a mask in public to set a good example for Americans. Sagar Magani, Washington.
Part of the CARES Act, a pandemic-related relief bill passed by the U.S. Congress, is set to expire soon. With that in mind, it's been a busy time on Capitol Hill as economic and health experts testify in front of congressional committees about the devastating economic impact of COVID-19. VOA correspondent Mariama Diallo reports.
President Donald Trump says the positive jobs report Thursday shows the U.S. economy is, quote, roaring back from the coronavirus. U.S. employers added nearly 5 million jobs in June, and the unemployment rate fell to 11.1%.
It's coming back extremely strong. We have some areas where we're putting out the flames or the fires, and that's working out well. We're working very closely with governors, and I think it's working out very well.
Earlier this week, testifying before the House Financial Services Committee, U.S. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin says the next round of economic aid should focus on struggling businesses such as restaurants and hotels.
We would anticipate that any additional relief would be targeted to certain industries that have been especially hard hit by the pandemic, with a focus on jobs and putting all Americans back to work.
To alleviate some of the hardship caused by the pandemic, Congress allocated $660 billion for the Paycheck Protection Program to help business survive and keep their employees. PPP was set to expire on Tuesday, but the Senate approved a temporary extension until August 8th. Another provision of the CARES Act, $600 weekly unemployment benefits, will expire later this month.
The PPP is keeping tens of millions of employees connected to their jobs. Economic impact payments are also helping millions of families and workers through these challenging months. Certain industries, such as construction, are recovering quickly, while others, such as retail and travel, are facing longer impacts and may require additional relief.
Jerome Powell, chairman of the Federal Reserve, says while recent economic data offers some positive signs, it's important to remember that more than 20 million Americans have recently lost their jobs.
The rise in joblessness has been especially severe for lower-wage workers, for women, and for African Americans and Hispanics. The path forward for the economy remains extraordinarily uncertain and will depend in large part on our success in containing the virus.
New coronavirus infections have skyrocketed in many parts of the U.S., in some cases more than doubled in June in at least 10 states, including Texas and Florida.
We are now having 40-plus thousand new cases a day. I would not be surprised if we go up to 100,000 a day if this does not turn around, and so I am very concerned.
It's a reality that Anthony Fauci and other top health officials warn could get worse unless some people change their behavior.
That you've seen of people congregating, often without masks, of being in crowds, and jumping over and avoiding and not paying attention to the guidelines that we very carefully put out, we're going to continue to be in a lot of trouble. And there's going to be a lot of hurt if that does not stop.
As a result of the spike in new cases, at least 19 states have put a brake on reopening plans. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Washington.
In a rebuke to President Donald Trump, the two top Democrats in Congress said Thursday that any threats to U.S. troops must be pursued relentlessly after they received a highly classified briefing about intelligence that Russia offered bounties for killing U.S. troops in Afghanistan. Trump has called reports of the intel assessments a hoax and has so far declined to say if the U.S. will respond. We hear more now from AP correspondent Ed Donahue.
Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer was briefed on assessments Russia offered bounties to kill U.S. troops in Afghanistan.
I believe that the president is not close to tough enough on Vladimir Putin.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi responded to the White House insistence President Trump wasn't briefed because the assessments weren't verified.
The White House put on a con that if you don't have 100% consensus on intelligence, that we shouldn't be, it shouldn't rise to a certain level.
Secretary of State Mike Pompeo says this was handled incredibly well.
We took this seriously. We handled it appropriately.
President Trump has called news reports a hoax. Ed Donahue, Washington.
If elected, Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden would reverse President Trump's decisions to withdraw from the Iran nuclear deal and the Paris Climate Change Accord. But VOA's Brian Patton reports there are other foreign policy areas like North Korea's nuclear program and withdrawing U.S. troops from Afghanistan and Syria, where the differences between the two presidential contenders seem less clear.
Joe Biden slammed President Trump on Tuesday for what Biden sees as the president's passive response to intelligence reports the Russians paid Taliban fighters to kill American soldiers. Trump claims he was not brief and that the reports were not credible.
So the idea that somehow he didn't know or isn't being briefed, it is a dereliction of duty if that's the case. And if he was briefed and nothing was done about this, that's a dereliction of duty.
Biden, who was President Barack Obama's vice president, has been a fierce critic of what Biden calls Trump's haphazard and dangerous foreign policy. In January, he said Trump put the U.S. on the brink of war after a U.S. airstrike killed a top Iranian general in retaliation for deadly Iranian-backed attacks on Americans in Iraq.
The failure to consult with our allies or Congress and the reckless disregard for the consequences that would surely follow was, in my view, dangerously incompetent.
However, tensions eased after Iran retaliated with a non-lethal missile attack against a U.S. military base in Iraq. In contrast to Trump's reliance on unilateral action to confront U.S. security threats, Biden promises to work closely with Democratic allies and prioritize negotiation over confrontation. Biden is closer to Trump's position on ending U.S. military involvement in Afghanistan and Syria, continuing negotiations with North Korea to end its nuclear program, and confronting China's suppression of human rights in Hong Kong. But critics question how effective Biden can be in leading an international response with the left wing of the Democratic Party opposed to military interventions. Add to that pressing domestic challenges Biden would face in the coronavirus pandemic, growing unemployment, and racial injustice protests at home.
He's got a huge and very expensive agenda that he's already signed up to. So the likelihood of a sort of traditional revival of American assertive leadership and particularly intervention in crises, I'm a little bit skeptical of.
Biden would likely rejoin the Iran nuclear deal negotiated by the Obama administration that Trump pulled out of, arguing the accord did not limit ballistic missile development and support for Iranian-backed militias. Biden would recommit the U.S. to the Paris Climate Accord signed by nearly 200 countries, cutting greenhouse gas emissions from cars and factories to counter global warming. But Biden said he would not rejoin the Obama-era Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Pact that Trump rejected until stronger protections for labor and American jobs are added. Brian Patton, VOA News, Washington.
Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and a broad range of U.S. lawmakers condemned China's imposition of a sweeping new security law on Hong Kong. The new rules drew bipartisan warnings from lawmakers that the Chinese Communist Party could face new sanctions for cracking down on freedom of speech and assembly in a city that is legally supposed to have a high degree of autonomy from China. VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson wraps up the reaction from Washington.
The first arrests under the new security law, put into effect on the 23rd anniversary of the handover from British to Chinese rule. Under that agreement, Hong Kong was supposed to operate under a one country, two systems principle. U.S. officials say that is now effectively over.
Free Hong Kong was one of the world's most stable, prosperous, and dynamic cities. Now it will be just another communist-run city where its people will be subject to the party elite's whims.
The annual march marking the anniversary of the handover now has very different implications because of the new law, which the U.S. and other Western nations say curbs freedoms, including the right to assembly and free speech.
Normally, this anniversary would have occasioned peaceful demonstrations. Instead, the new law has brought scores of arrests and boasts from local authorities about how many peaceful demonstrators they've jailed. New harsh penalties for Hong Kongers for new and vague offenses. New authorities for Beijing to intervene at will.
Ambiguities in the law, which was passed in secret without the input from Hong Kong authorities, concerns U.S. lawmakers.
Is it retroactive? Do they go back to any flying of flags or making of statements? Or is it from now forward, which would be horrible enough? But that is a fear that I have.
Lawmakers also concerned suspects under the new restrictions could be forced to stand trial in mainland China.
We need to watch very carefully what happens next, particularly against groups and individuals who I'm pretty sure the Chinese government will target to make an example of in the early days after the passage of that bill.
The broad outlines of the law are already enough reason for concern, one analyst told Congress.
Extensive involvement of China's central security officials in the enforcement of this law is particularly worrying when we combine it with the broadly defined offenses.
The U.S. Senate unanimously passed a bill last week sanctioning officials, banks, and other entities who enable the new law. And more action is possible.
I think you'll see additional responses by Congress in terms of sanctions to try to convince the Chinese Communist Party that the cost is too high. They need to reconsider.
But Democratic lawmakers say that U.S. leverage over China has decreased during the Trump administration.
At the end of the day, it's the White House that sets policy. And I fear that our policy has gone astray, perhaps emboldening China.
Lawmakers say the people of Hong Kong can count on the support of America.
This is a battle between democracy and dictatorship, between liberty and tyranny, and between freedom and oppression. And it is a battle that the world must win.
Congress is moving quickly to pass a sanctions bill into law. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Washington.
The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Michelle Bachelet, warns Venezuela's social and economic crisis will not go away until its profound political crisis is resolved through government negotiations with political opponents. The High Commissioner presented her latest update Thursday to the UN Human Rights Council in Geneva. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA.
United Nations agencies report more than 4 million Venezuelans have fled poverty, hunger, human rights violations, and political persecution in recent years. This is the largest recorded refugee and migration crisis in the Americas. Most have sought refuge in countries in Latin America. UN Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet tells the UN Council that conditions in Venezuela remain grim. She speaks through an interpreter.
People in Venezuela continue to suffer grave violations of economic and social rights due to low salaries, high food prices, persisting deficiencies in public services such as electricity, water, and fuel shortages, as well as precarious access to health care. The crisis has been exacerbated by the increase in sectoral sanctions and the COVID-19 pandemic.
Bachelet criticizes U.S. economic sanctions on the government of Nicolas Maduro for intensifying the suffering of millions of Venezuelans. The U.S. sanctions include the freezing of individual accounts and assets, prohibiting individuals, companies, and countries from doing business with the Venezuelan government, seizing of assets, arms embargoes, and travel bans. In August, U.S. President Donald Trump imposed new economic sanctions targeting Venezuela's petroleum, gold, mining, food, and banking industries. In a letter to the U.S. Congress, President Trump explained that he had imposed the new measures, quote, in light of the continued usurpation of power by Nicolas Maduro and persons affiliated with him, as well as human rights abuses, arbitrary arrest, and detention of Venezuelan citizens. Venezuelan ambassador to the U.N. in Geneva, Jorge Valero, lambasts the new measures imposed by the U.S. Trump administration. He blames them for causing pain, death, and suffering of the Venezuelan people. He speaks through an interpreter by video link.
We see a continuation of the abduction of the assets of Venezuela abroad, the freezing and pillaging of billions of dollars in foreign banks, which deny the Venezuelan state the resources it needs to acquire food, medicine, and medical inputs abroad.
The report presented by the High Commissioner documents restrictions to the civic and democratic space in Venezuela. Bachelet says the government continues to violate freedom of expression and to detain political leaders, journalists, and people protesting for public services. She also expresses concern about what she calls the pattern of arbitrary detentions and violations, including allegations of torture and enforced disappearances by security forces. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
In the midst of a pandemic and a laundry list of breaking news daily, one story may have been lost in the shuffle. Lawsuits filed last week against some of the world's biggest oil companies claim they knowingly concealed the role their products play in the damage done by climate change. Joining us to talk more about it is Richard Wiles, Executive Director of the Center for Climate Integrity. Tell us where the lawsuits are coming from and what they're about.
So Minnesota and the District of Columbia filed suit against Exxon. And in Minnesota's case, the Koch brothers and API, the American Petroleum Institute, the trade association for the oil industry. And D.C. filed a similar suit against Exxon and other oil majors. Basically, both governments filed suit under consumer protection laws that are in place in both locales. So the cases under that law, they're basically saying that Exxon, Koch, API, the other oil majors lied about what they knew about climate change and deliberately misled the public about the fact that they knew that their products would cause climate change, and they certainly didn't tell the public that. They told them the exact opposite through a series. One case focused on advertising. The other focuses more on their overarching, what we'll call, disinformation campaign for the past 40 years. But they're both about lying and violation of consumer protection law that, you know, basically does not permit a fraud to be perpetrated on the citizens of the district or of the state of Minnesota.
What time frame were they talking about these violations occurring?
Well, the court will ultimately decide what period of time the violations occurred. But roughly, I would say, since around 1990, one case is 1980, one case is 1990. So 30 to 40 years, we'll say, of the industry actively engaging in disinformation and deception about what it knew about its products and the fact that they caused climate change.
Why these two entities, you know, Minnesota and Washington, D.C., and why just these companies?
These are two cases. There are at least 16 other cases that are very similar. Two attorneys general cases by the state of Massachusetts, which is very similar to these consumer protection fraud cases. One by the state of Rhode Island, which is slightly different, which is more like the tobacco litigation, where they're saying you knew and you lied about it, and now we want you to pay for the damage that you've caused that you knew your products would cause. So there's two more states that have filed slightly different suits. And then there's 14 municipalities, all of whom have filed cases arguing that the company knew and they lied, just like Minnesota and D.C. But they're saying, and you knew that your products, when used as directed, if you will, would cause damages that we would have to pay for. You know, it'd be it building seawalls or cooling centers or dealing with heavy rainfalls or all of the impacts of climate change that these municipalities are in. the state of Rhode Island having to deal with. So there's 18 suits right now against the oil majors, and probably more to come.
How do they prove their case that the companies were fully aware of what they were doing and saying?
So over the past 5 years or so, there have been reporters, investigative journalists, researchers at universities have uncovered a trove of internal documents that go back to the 1960s and the 70s, where the companies, in particular Exxon, were very clear. These are internal memos where their own scientists are saying that our products will cause climate change. There's scientific consensus that the burning of fossil fuels will warm the planet, you know, that the uncontrolled use of fossil fuels in our products will lead to potentially catastrophic outcomes. And those are their own words, by 2030, 2040, 2050. So those are the reason they think they can prove the case is because they've got internal documents from the companies that show clearly that the companies knew, that the C-suite executives knew. And then around 1990 or so, 1980 really through 1990, there was a shift inside the companies from at least being concerned about their products to one where they put together a massive coordinated campaign among all of the oil majors and fossil fuel companies to actively confuse the public and to plant the seeds of doubt about the science, where they knew there really wasn't any doubt because their own internal science had pretty clearly demonstrated, and they had written it down in many different places in many different ways, that their products were definitely going to warm the planet. But then they decided, instead of doing the right thing, that they were going to basically try to preserve profits and run a massive disinformation campaign and delay action as long as they could. In fact, they're still doing the same thing. They're still actively trying to misrepresent what their business is actually doing in terms of climate change. You know, if you watch TV at all, you would think that Exxon is an algae company. You know, an algae is, you know, whatever, 0.001% of their energy production at this point. So, you know, they're still actively engaged in trying to confuse the public about how devastating the continued use of their products will be to the planet.
What are they asking for?
There's a number of different remedies that are being sought, but generally speaking, most of the cases are seeking compensation for the damages and for all of the adaptation measures they'll have to take. You know, essentially think of it as they want Exxon and Shell and BP to, you know, pay for the seawalls that they're going to have to build and all the other things.
Richard Wiles, Executive Director of the Center for Climate Integrity. Thank you so much for being with us. Here are some of the other stories we're following at VOA. Russia claimed victory on Thursday following results of a nationwide vote that handed President Vladimir Putin the right to run for two more terms. But an independent monitoring group said the vote had not been free and the outcome was flawed. Final results after the week-long vote showed that nearly 78% of voters had backed changes to the Constitution, allowing Putin potentially two more six-year terms after his current one ends in 2024. The British government says it will end coronavirus quarantine rules for those arriving from 75 countries so that people can go on holiday. It says the UK will shortly lift a ban on non-essential travel to nearly all EU destinations. The British territories, including Bermuda and Gibraltar, and Turkey, Thailand, Australia, and New Zealand. For over 160 years, a statue of the 7th U.S. President, Andrew Jackson, has stood in front of the White House in Washington, D.C., but now people want to tear it down. Last week, protesters tried to do just that to the Jackson statue, which has stood outside the White House since the 1850s. Yesterday, we learned about Jackson's brutal treatment of Native Americans. Today, VOA's Jason Patinkin takes a closer look at Jackson's complicated legacy around race and democracy.
Hey, ho, ho. Andrew Jackson, Jackson, go.
The statue shows Jackson in military uniform sitting atop a horse with its front hooves raised in the air. The protesters wanted to pull down the statue because of Jackson's brutality toward Native Americans and because Jackson owned black slaves. The protesters failed after being attacked by police, and four people have been arrested for damaging the statue. But the statue is now a flashpoint in a wider debate in the United States over whether or not to tear down statues to historical racists like Jackson, as the U.S. reckons with its painful past amid widespread protests. U.S. President Donald Trump has strongly defended Jackson, threatening lengthy jail sentences to those who try to pull down such statues. When Trump became president, he hung Jackson's portrait in the Oval Office. So why does Andrew Jackson stir such opposing views among Americans? Here's Professor Eric Foner of Columbia University in New York.
Andrew Jackson is a complicated and somewhat contradictory figure, as many important figures in history are. Jackson was the symbol of what we call Jacksonian democracy, the period in the 1820s and 1830s where the vast majority of white men received the right to vote, where you have two major political parties competing actively all over the country. And this creates a very vibrant political atmosphere at a time when there were very, very few countries in the world where most men could vote. Now, of course, Jacksonian democracy excludes a lot of people. Women could not vote. African Americans mostly could not vote, although in a few northern states they could. But nonetheless, it was a significant expansion of political democracy in the United States. On the other hand, the expansion of the rights of white people seemed to somehow go hand in hand with limiting the rights of non-white people. So, for example, it's in this period, actually, that the right to vote is taken away from adult black men in several states, where they had been able to vote all the way since the American Revolution. Suddenly they're excluded from it.
This dual legacy of expanding rights for some while limiting rights for others is at the heart of the debate around Jackson's statue. It's also not the first time Jackson's legacy has been the subject of controversy. Jackson's image has long been on banknotes for 20 U.S. dollar bills, but during Barack Obama's presidency, the U.S. Treasury announced it would replace Jackson's image with a picture of Harriet Tubman, a black former slave who helped hundreds of others escape slavery in the U.S. South. That decision was reversed when Trump took office. Foner says one reason why Trump defends Jackson's monument and monuments to other historical racists is because he wants to appeal to racist sentiments among his supporters.
President Trump is a master of what we sometimes call backlash politics, that is, trying to gain political strength by appealing to white resentment against gains of African Americans and others. And so, obviously, when the president speaks out in favor of these representations of racist figures from our past, he's signaling something to white America. I'm on your side, basically. You don't have to worry about the complaints of these other people.
Foner says Trump also reveres Jackson because the seventh president has long been a symbol of the common man. Trump himself was born into great wealth, but he tries to portray himself as the champion of regular working folks.
He wants to say, look, I am the representative of ordinary Americans, not the elites. And that's the same thing with Jackson. Jackson made it very clear, you know, he stood up for the common man, so to speak, or at least the common white man. Trump wants to gain that image.
So should there be a statue to Jackson outside the White House?
If you're going to have Andrew Jackson there, why don't we put up another statue near it, like Frederick Douglass, the great black abolitionist, or maybe John Ridge, or one of the Native Americans who tried to resist being removed from Georgia and Alabama and places like that. The public presentation of history in this country now is very one-dimensional. There are very few statues of black Americans. There are very few statues of Native Americans. The reason is that statues are an expression of power. Who has the power to choose which pieces of history are commemorated or not? And the people with power in our society have been white men, basically. Whether you take down statues or put up more statues of different kinds of people, I think the ultimate aim is to have a presentation of history that really reflects the diversity of this country.
Jason Patinkin for VOA News, Washington.
And finally, today, amid tight security, popular Ethiopia singer Hachalu Hundessa, who was shot dead this week, was buried in his hometown of Ambo on Thursday amid tight security. Hundessa had been a prominent voice in anti-government protests that led to a change in leadership in 2018. The singer's killing further raised tensions in Ethiopia, where the government recently delayed the national election, citing the coronavirus pandemic.
You've been listening to International Edition. That's it for our show today, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Bunganyi, I'm Lori London in Washington. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great weekend.